Good evening and welcome to Little Atoms with me, Padraig Reedy, and my co-host, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a live talk show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the world of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. If the show has a dominant and recurring theme, then it coalesces around the ideas of the Enlightenment, by which we mean freedom of expression, free inquiry, empirical rationalism, scepticism, the scientific method, secular humanism, and liberal democracy. These ideas find their antithesis in superstition, religious fundamentalism, fanaticism, medievalism, totalitarianism, censorship, and conspiracy theory. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. I will hand over to Neil to introduce this week's guest, David Aronovich.
Thanks, Padraig. David Aronovich is a writer, broadcaster, and commentator on international politics and the media. He started his media career in television, working as a producer on ITV's Weekend World and the BBC's On the Record. He's previously written for The Guardian, The Observer and The Independent, winning numerous accolades, including Columnist of the Year 2003 and the Orwell Prize for Journalism in 2001. As a broadcaster, he has appeared on the satirical TV current affairs programme Have I Got News For You? And has made radio broadcasts on historical topics. David is currently a regular columnist for The Times. His most recent book is Voodoo History, The Role of Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. And this is David's third appearance on Little Atom, so welcome back, David.
Thank you.
The first appearance was over 3 years ago, and after that show you told us that you were working on a book about conspiracy theory, and you had been for some time,
yeah.
And in fact it was all already a bit of a bane to you that you're having to trawl for all this stuff, and then it's taken the intervening 3 years to finish and come out. So basically that's a hell of a lot of work to put into something that's... Why? I mean, why? What was the fascination?
Well, firstly, obviously, I kept on encountering plots to stop me finishing the book. The fascination, I mean, actually, I loved Padraig's list of isms. I felt myself becoming intellectually moist, as Stephen Fry would say, as these kind of list of things that I feel myself either in favour of or against came up. And actually, that list rather explains the book, doesn't it? Because if you're generally in favour of those things, then in that case you're generally worried by things like conspiracy theories. At a couple of levels, really. The first is because they're anti-rationalist, or they seem anti-rationalist. Second, because they're dangerous, or they can be dangerous. And then there's the kind of third element for people like us, I suspect, which is a kind of slight... an awkward determination against what seems like to us sometimes the odds to win this argument. And so in that sense, I kind of place this book in a line along with Ben Goldacre's Bad Science book and Damien Thompson's Counter Knowledge and so on, as part of, if you like, the sceptical counterblast mm-hmm. to this enormous profusion of crap theories and crap ideas, which have got really significant play over the course of the last decade, and then, as I said, there's just the kind of part of me that really, 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 really wants to win the argument. And what better way to win the argument than to write a long book which sets out your arguments in full?
But one of the issues with conspiracy theorists that we're coming up against is the argument is basically unwinnable. I mean, you can't argue against these people, can you? Because they don't follow the normal rules.
If the objective is to take the most determined conspiracy theorist and convince them, and you're absolutely right, that's a lost cause. Very committed conspiracy theorists are as attached to their theories as any significant religious person is to their faith, or any political ideologue is to a political ideology that they really don't want to give up. But there are lots and lots of people on the kind of edges of these discussions who can be influenced by conspiracy theories and can maybe be brought to think that they're true, who may easily, quite fairly easily, if arguments are placed before them, be detached from them. And it's really important that they encounter these other arguments. So these other arguments are somewhere there in the ether and easily available to them, and that they're also being talked about, and that they're also part of the discussion. Because I think if you do that, then you actually do have a chance. Going back again to the Ben Goldacre book, Bad Science is an absolute bestseller. You know, it sits there at the top of the bestseller charts, and Ben's done a fantastic job. Now, funnily enough, he chaired a session with me about this book, my book, at one of the Central London bookshops, and he was much more gloomy than me about the possibility of changing people's minds about these about this sort of things. But I do think there's something of what I call, you know, with my ineffable pomposity, the war against stupidity, which is there to be fought and actually, to a certain extent, there to be won. And let's make it even kind of longer job of this while we're about it. We know that we have undergone and are undergoing an information revolution, and the sources of information available to young people, let's say to my kids, who are currently 19, 16 and 12, are at a level which we never dreamed of. I never dreamed of when I was younger. Now, what's going to be increasingly important as that information revolution deepens is the capacity to create spaces which, if you like, almost have a kind of rationalist kite mark on them. In other words, where people can go and which and which have a sort of badge of quality to them. People laugh at this, at this possibility. I don't think they're going to for very long. I think it's going to be one of the big discussions of the next 5 to 10 years is how we do that.
Mm. A lot of the discussion around the information revolution, so to speak, is based around the idea that, my God, there's so much misinformation out there. But you seem to be casting it in a more positive light, Simon, that there is an opportunity here.
Yeah, there is. There is. I mean, let's take 9/11 conspiracy theories. It's true that the Google, what I call the algorithm of desire, which puts up the first pages on Google and so on, will often consist of let's say 9/11, conspiracy theories about 9/11. But you can create a sort of an understanding that there are sites like 9/11 Myths, which is a brilliant debunking site. Just about every conspiracist argument that's ever been put forward, right the way through Loose Change and so on, has been dealt with by people who've actually gone out and found out the counterfacts. Now, of course, on the whole, governments aren't going to do that. Governments and police force and security agencies don't tend to defend themselves from these accusations because they're too busy being governments, defence forces and security agencies. And so why should they take on these people? It seems kind of irrational. So, you know, the theories are left to fester. So people like 9/11 Myths, voluntary people in America who just, you know, like the James Randi Educational Foundation people, and so on, I've just had enough of this crap, and so on, have really, really done their work. Well, let's get it out there. You know, nobody listening to this can now say they don't know where to find it.
Why is it important to win this argument? I mean, a lot of, again, people have always believed stupid things, and people will say, well, maybe believing that Kennedy was shot by the CIA or the KGB or whoever the hell it was is essentially harmless because these guys are, you know, nuts in front of a keyboard. Why does it matter that we win this argument?
Yeah, there's a kind of bully argument that I can put to that, which is, you know, sort of which is kind of the Trump argument, which is let's take this, what's going on in the Swat Valley in Pakistan. We had a report in the Times just 2 weeks ago from Anatole Levin to say that the belief there in 9/11 conspiracy theories actually is a demobilizing factor in getting the Pakistani population and even the security forces to fight the Taliban. It actually does affect whether people think that battle's worth fighting and how they fight it. And these theories, by and large, will originate with 9/11 truthers and so on in America and so on, and then kind of spread out. And they say, look, you know, even the Americans believe this, you know. So at that level, or if we were just to take something like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, famously, we know that it had an impact in terms of the growth of anti-Semitism after the First World War, and therefore played some role, and how much role after you want it to play, in the events leading up to the Holocaust. Now, if you're talking about something like John Kennedy, I think if there are a series of people who kind of passively believe that John Kennedy was murdered by a conspiracy, it's not doing very much harm, except that they have a kind of model in their minds of how life works, which is essentially wrong. And it's not on that subject itself that will send them wrong particularly. It's a historical subject. It's when they next encounter something which somebody says is like John F. Kennedy, then the thing that what they don't have in their heads is that the thing which is actually like John F. Kennedy is the lone gunman. Mm-hmm. Right. They don't have that model in their heads because that's not what is available to them. So those are the reasons why it matters. And then it matters at a kind of altogether sort of slightly different level. And here's where I can be accused of being pedantic, maybe. It matters because one is true and one isn't. Okay. And it matters trying to get at the true versions of history and the true versions of science, you know, insofar as we can know them. That effort matters. Mm-hmm.
But you will get people who say, well, you know, who would cast your argument saying, well, you know, there are no conspiracies. You know, whenever you try to argue with a conspiracy theorist, they'll say, well, what about Bay of Tonkin or, you know, Lusitania or something else? That you're the one who's accepting all these official lines. Mm. So how do you counter that argument?
Well, I mean, you know, usually there is some evidence available to you. I mean, let's take the Gulf of Tonkin, which is... You know, the assertion of the Gulf of Tonkin is that the Americans said they had been fired on by the North Vietnamese when they knew they hadn't, and used it as an excuse to get the congressional resolution which allowed them to bomb North Vietnam. Now, it's pretty clear that actually the Americans did think that they'd been fired on. They were wrong, but they thought it. In that sense... the Gulf of Tonkin is actually a little bit more like weapons of mass destruction than it is like a kind of deliberate creation of a pretext. It's one of those things that governments think because of what's happened before. So it fits into, if you like, a confirmatory bias, actually, mm-hmm. which is a very kind of common trait, better than conspiracy theories. And actually, confirmatory bias is a very useful thing to know and to think about, partially because we're all... guilty of it from time to time, but also because institutions can be particularly guilty. If we think about a police force that gets it into their head that X is the guilty person and forgets to look at the other possible theories, including quite likely ones, and that way you get some of the biggest miscarriages of justice are consequences of confirmatory bias. So if your model is conspiracy theories rather than seeing, for instance, the possibility of confirmatory bias, you can't really deal with the latter.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you bring up the WMD. I think a couple of the reviews of your book I've read have come up with this idea that, well, you know, in your own belief in the existence, at least, of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, that you were drawn into a conspiracy theory yourself.
I find this really irritating. And one of the reasons I find it irritating was because I absolutely, specifically said in the period before the war, I am an agnostic on the question of weapons of mass destruction. Said it absolutely outright. Skeptical about the claims that Saddam actually had links with Islamist terrorism, and agnostic on the question of weapons of mass destruction. How could I know whether they were there or not? All I knew was that the, as far as I could see, was that the British intelligence service were telling the British Prime Minister and other leaders that the WMD was there. So when somebody, even if it's somebody who I love of old, effectively tells me that I should admit to having been duped when I never was, it is just slightly kind of irritating. They can speak for themselves. If they were duped and they wish to recant, fine. Let them do it. I wasn't duped. I wanted Saddam Hussein removed as leader of Iraq. And I tell you what, although I wouldn't have gone for it if I'd known the level of suffering that would have been caused, I still find it pretty hard to regret that Saddam Hussein is no longer leader of Iraq, and still think we would have been dealing with some kind of problem. So, you know, some of my erstwhile friends can chew on that one.
You did famously write that if the weapons of mass destruction weren't found, that nobody would ever trust the government again, and you certainly
and they didn't.
Wouldn't. This is true.
And they didn't. And they didn't. But it wasn't true of me. It wasn't true of me. And I actually wrote a year later. So this is 2004 to 2003. So this is now 5 years ago. That was one of the stupidest things I've ever written. And actually, I was pondering this because this gets thrown at me every bloody. And I deserve it, of course. You write something stupid, you deserve to have it kind of thrown back at you. But I was thinking, you know, journalists get their kind of book, their collected columns. I was thinking of getting my worst columns and worst predictions and something, and putting that in a book entitled something like "Crap Columns I've Written" or something like that, and so you know, and sticking that together. Although it has to be said, I believe it's a much shorter book than some other people's.
I think Orwell had that idea that you should bring out an annual almanac of bad journalistic predictions.
Absolutely, Private Eye does tend to do it.
Well, we're We're about halfway through the show. You're listening to Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny, and with Padraig Reedy, and we're talking to David Ivanovich about his book, Voodoo Histories. You've already mentioned the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. It's one of the ones I wanted to bring up as being a conspiracy theory that was and we can still say, I suppose, still is dangerous. In the book, there's a really great potted history of what they were and where they came from and what's happened. So perhaps we could talk about those in a little bit more detail.
Sure. Well, I mean, the following through of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the thing to remember is that they really surface as a kind of political factor in the period immediately after the First World War and are pretty rapidly translated into English, French, German. They're circulating in the Atlantic. And what they purport to be is a record of a meeting of sort of significant Jewish figures at which they talk about how they are going to take over all the political parties, all the newspapers, flood the world with pornography, create lots of wars in order to construct a situation of such anarchy that in this terrible moment, and all the sort of great empires and kingdoms of Europe will tumble and so will the churches, etc. And in this moment of great anarchy, people will turn around and say, what do we need? We need world government by Jews. We might regard that as being about as kind of reasonable as David Icke's shape-shifting reptilians taking over the world. Actually, it is pretty much
the same story.
Yes, pretty much the same story. The thing to remember is that in May of 1920, the Times believed that there was such a significant chance of this being true. It actually wrote an editorial saying, we need an inquiry into whether we fought this war to avoid what they called a Pax Germanicum, only to find ourselves in the much worse situation, a Pax Judaicum. This is the Times, this is the editor of the Times talking. Same with the Spectator, same in the Morning Post and so on. I think the Spectator even went so far as to suggest, or maybe it was one of the other magazines, that Jews be temporarily barred from the civil service and politics while this issue was investigated. Well, next year, the Times correspondent in Constantinople is in discussion with a white Russian, a Russian emigre who's living in Constantinople, and this chap gives him a small book. And that small book is a book published in probably France or maybe it's the Low Countries in the 1860s. And it's called Dialogues Between Montesquieu and Machiavelli in Hell. And it is effectively a kind of rather leaden satire on Napoleon III's France. But this is the thing. Large sections of this book are verbatim what then appear in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. In other words, it's a straight lift. And when you trace it back, it looks as if that it was created by some member of the Tsarist secret police in Paris in the 1890s and then went to Russia and so on and was circulated around.
So nothing to do with the Jews whatsoever. This was written about some, section of society.
No, something totally to do with non-Jews, actually. But by then, it's entered into a series of countries, obviously notably Germany. The example which I also give in the book, because it was fairly recent, to me anyway, was that if you take somebody like Dacier de Pellepoix, who was the Vichy's commissioner for Jewish affairs, who had been a sort of boulevardier and a ne'er-do-well in the period just before the war, but also sort of associated with some right-wing politics, a man of absolutely no convictions whatsoever, except where he was going to get his next hotel bill from. Except one. He was convinced that the Protocols of the Elders of Zion were true. And as commissioner for Jewish affairs, played a major role in the rounding up and the sending of Jews in Vichy France to the gas chambers. So this kind of, you know, just in this one example, you can see, and not from Germany either, but from France, the role that this document played, and still does play, because references to the protocols are to be found on Hamas television, on Iranian television, kind of constantly. It's in the Hamas charter, it's on Hezbollah's TV, and so on. And this kind of notion of, you know, sort of what Jews do and so on is really, it's an enormous impediment. It's obviously not the only impediment, but it's an enormous impediment to finding the conditions for peace with such people.
Do you think, to what extent do you think that people that are using this now are using this document because it's something, it's you know, a voodoo historical thing, but a historical document that people have heard of and people know about, and they can use that for their own ends? Or do you think people actually still genuinely believe?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good question with something like the Hamas Charter. I think when they put it in the Hamas Charter, they believed it. They were a small movement then. They didn't have very many members. You know, there probably wasn't the kind of internal discussion that could have said to somebody, look, Hamid, that's a fairly kind of stupid thing. I'm not really sure about this, isn't it? And it's quite possible that amongst sort of more enlightened sections of Hamas, that kind of process has happened. You know, it has tended to be a kind of sectary. But you can't say the same about, say, Iranian television, which is absolutely full of stuff about the protocols. Now, you might think that Iranian people, and this is probably true, actually don't take their own television terribly seriously, you know, and you certainly hope not, don't you? Mm-hmm. But there's the danger.
Okay, well, we're not got long left, so every time you're on the show, David, we always end up talking about the cynicism of the public with politicians, and over the years it's gradually got worse and worse, and now we're in this sort of mess at the moment with the expenses claims, and every day there's new revelations at the Telegraph, and there's new MPs being, you know, dragged into the Star Chamber to talk about the expenses. So you've written about this, and as usual, I think you think that people are being somewhat over the top.
Well, I mean, I call it a kind of reverse Princess Diana moment, really, which is, you know, during the Princess Diana, it was people getting in touch with their grief, wasn't it? Their inner grief by connection with the grief about Diana. And this is with people getting in touch with their inner anger and letting their anger kind of rip. And the consequence of this is that all kinds of MPs are being thrown in, let's say, with the worst offenders, as being effectively are being called crooks. And not only that, but they're having to go through what Julie Kirkbride, I'm not a Tory and I'm not particularly sympathetic to her politically, but I'm not. But what she had to go through in the period before she decided to stand down in terms of telling people what her domestic arrangements were in order to get their approval was so humiliating and so pathetic. I felt embarrassed having to listen to it. But when she wrote for The Times, on the Times' website, the comments that came after her were punitive and hateful to an extent that, again, I felt embarrassed. I felt far more embarrassed for the people, actually, who were making those comments than I did about anything that she'd done with expenses. Because what she'd done might, you know, at the worst might be regarded as being slightly kind of greedy within the rules. What the people were doing in response to her was just nasty. And that's, you know, there's a difference between sort of not being kind of brilliant with about money, and, you know, as you know, a lot of people are, and so on, because most people will claim up to the edge of the allowances that they're allowed to have. In my experience, on the whole, they will. And the only one of the few people I exempt from this is myself, because I'm so incapable of filling out forms that I never do claim anything. But people who can fill in forms have a kind of tendency to, and if they don't, then their spouses make sure that they do. And the attitude towards her, and I thought it was captured in our paper very well by the cartoon this morning, which had a picture of a sign saying Bromsgrove twinned with Luton. It's got a kind of, you know, leafy lane and so on, a house down there, and a noose hanging off a tree, and so on. And that's it. So some of this has become kind of lynch lore. And of course, journalists too imbibe this. They see that there is public anger, and we dignify public anger. If there's some such thing as public anger, you're not allowed to argue against it. You're not allowed to say it's misplaced, because then you're not in touch somehow. You're kind of, well, actually, I am bloody well in touch. I'm in touch with the fact that people are actually behaving in a stupid way. I mean, they really are behaving in a stupid way. And in about a year's time, some people, I hope, are kind of think slightly kind of better of it, and so on. I'm not saying it's right to have claimed these expenses, although I can see how that situation kind of developed. And I can now also see an opportunity for reform, which hasn't existed for some time. And I'm sort of, you know, pretty keen to go down there like a rat up a drainpipe and get some of the reform done, because it's been bloody difficult to do.
So what do you think will happen?
I don't know what will happen, but I know what I want to happen. You know, I want reform of the voting system. I want to see primaries and people brought into the business of primaries. I'd like to see fewer MPs paid a proper level of salary and without an expense allowance per se, and expenses that they have to claim. I would like to see a whole kind of, you know, a whole kind of raft of changes on select committees and so on. And I'd also like to see a recognition that, as the writer John Keane has said in his new book, this new history of democracy is done, that we have actually moved into a new stage of democracy in which there are all kinds of other bodies monitoring what leaders and politicians and other people do. And if we recognise that that's where we're at, I think we're going to be better able to deal with, if you like, the kind of what people describe as the disenchantment with representative democracy.
So what other bodies are you talking about then? Who is monitoring the government, say, apart from the press, which is...
Thousands of bodies. If you just think about the bodies which are supposed to set up, monitor MPs, for instance, which didn't exist 40 years ago, the bodies that monitor police that didn't exist 40 years ago, all the kinds of various bodies. Bodies like Liberty, which are much stronger now than they were than back in the days of the NCCL. We have, you know, things like the Human Rights Act, which effectively set up a kind of monetary system. The notion that the British people have lost rights vis-a-vis politicians in the last 50 years is precisely and diametrically wrong. Exactly the opposite has happened. Talk to Professor Conor Geertie, the professor of law at the LSE, about it. And, you know, this kind of image put around by people like Henry Porter and so on, that somehow or other we're all kind of shivering with the big kind of big foot of Big Brother over us, is almost precisely the opposite of what's happened. 50 years ago, if a copper didn't like the look of you, he could smash your face in, get you locked up for 5 years by a stipendiary magistrate, and there'd be bugger all you could do about it, and everybody knew it, so you stayed on the right side. Now, there's likely to be a CCTV camera in the cells that sees him doing it, and he's going to find himself in deep shit. Quite right, too.
That's point's been made, I think, by Conor Geertie, who said that the last two kind of civil liberties and political panics in this country were G20 protests and the current expenses row, which would not have happened without the IPPC and the Freedom of Information Act.
Exactly.
At all.
Exactly. It's the consequences, the unforeseen consequences of something like the Freedom of Information Act. And in John Keane's book, The Life and Death of Democracy, which must have been being written about a year ago, this is all wonderfully predicted. He said it's going to be often humiliating, incredibly difficult for politicians and so on. And one of the questions I've raised in the review I've written about his book tomorrow is that one problem we have is who monitors the monitors. You know, who actually does that business if they're actually going to exercise a degree of power? If we're going to recognise this is going to go on, how do we subject it to some form of accountability?
That's quite a meaty point to end on. David, thanks for joining us again.
If not incomprehensible.
You've been listening to Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny, and Padraig Reedy, and we've been talking to David Ivanovich about voodoo history and numerous other things. Thanks for listening.